from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll dig into a Gold Rush exhibit at the Idle George.
I'll chat with Jim Poyser about his work with Earth Charter Indiana and how the arts are a part of it.
And I'll find out about a new series of foodie tours around central Indiana. And we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. The insatiable pursuit of imaginable wealth is behind a new exhibition at the Idle Troop. Sharon Gamble invited curator Joanna Bloom to our studios to find out all about Gold, Riches, and Ruin opening this Saturday.
So there was more than one gold rush, right? Because there was gold a lot of places.
Absolutely. So the exhibit, we're focusing on three historic gold rushes primarily in the American West. So we're looking at California, which is the one I think most people think of when they think of gold rushes in the United States.
Yeah.
But we're also looking at the gold rush in the Black Hills in the 1870s and 1880s. That's the Black Hills of South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're also looking at the Yukon Klondike Gold Rush, which is technically in Canada, which is actually kind of one of the things that's really interesting about it, because at the time, a lot of people didn't realize that they were heading to Canada, that they were heading to another country, particularly American prospectors, and that posed some problems at the border.
Well, yeah.
And even to this day, a lot of people don't realize that that particular gold rush occurred in Canada, not in the United States, but it's still kind of part of the North American West.
I would think problems going into Canada, but also if you found gold, problems bringing it back.
Yep, absolutely.
Hours, they say. So how did it start? Was there, like, is there this great story of one person found gold in each of these territories and
just
built from there?
Well, there are certainly legends and sort of, you know, characters, real people who have been sort of built up into sort of a mythic status as a result of the gold rush. So, you know, with California, people often think of John Sutter and James Marshall. James Marshall worked for John Sutter at Sutter's Fort and is the one credited with finding the gold in the mill race. But there had been gold discoveries in California prior to that, but that was the one that really sort of triggered the massive rush. That's the one, you know, they sent nuggets back to Washington, D.C., and President Polk, you know, made his big statement to the Congress about gold in California, and that really spurred everybody forward and really is why California became a state so quickly.
Yeah. So was it just people seeking riches, or was there some, like, economic uncertainty that made people think, well, this is something super tangible. If I can get my hands on it, I'll be safer.
Well, if they thought that, I think that was rather foolhardy. I mean, it really was a gamble, absolutely. No question. You know, a lot of these people were leaving steady employment back home and, you know, safety and security with their friends and families and their communities and just sort of giving it all up on this off chance that they might strike it rich in a really big way, and that would make up for all of that sacrifice and all of that risk. Unfortunately, very few people did, at least in terms of striking it rich, you know, by hitting pay dirt, by finding gold.
Yeah.
Some of the biggest fortunes actually to come out of these gold rushes are not even people who were, you know, practicing mining. These are the people who we like to say went out to mine the miners, you know, the folks who went out to start merchandise stores and outfitters and, you know, the folks sort of supplying the folks who had to go out into, out into the wilderness to the diggings.
Sure, because they need stuff. They need food. They need clothes. Mm-hmm. They need services.
They need tools.
Yeah.
You know, it's the sort of the rise of the banking industry. Wells Fargo is a big part of this story.
So I have kind of a foolish question, because I think we all have this idea from maybe popular movies of how gold is actually panned for.
Mm-hmm.
But how, what was that process like? What kind of tools did you need? And I mean, how did people, how much territory would you stake out and say, I am looking for gold in this part of this this parcel of land? Or how did that work?
Well, it was a little different depending on where you were. And there were different rules and that governed staking a claim in these various places we're talking about in the exhibit. And tools are very much a part of that story. We have a lot of really great historic tools in the exhibit. I'm actually really excited about a lot of them. Because the actual practice of mining and the technology of mining is, again, different depending on where you are and where in time you are. So you know, a lot of people think about that gold pan and sort of swirling the pan in the water to find nuggets, that sort of thing. In what's called placer mining, that would usually be the first step. So you would do that to kind of gauge how productive a spot might be. So, you know, somebody looking for gold would go out and sort of test a spot in a creek or something to see if it was producing a lot of gold, if they could find a lot of gold in a panful. And if it seemed like it might be a productive spot, then you would kind of get into the next steps, which would involve building things like rocker boxes or sluice boxes, sometimes called rocker cradles. And they're these, it's kind of hard to describe, they're these big boxes that literally rock back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And you would shovel your dirt or your sediment that you were, you know, scooping out of the river or whatever, into the top of it and shake it. You'd rock it back and forth. And gravity, as you're running water through it, and so gravity and the water running through it would filter loose sediment, you know, dirt, not like big hunks of rock or anything.
Sure.
Would filter that through this screen on the top and wash it away. And then the gold, you know, because it's so much heavier than water, would sink down to the bottom too and would catch in these things called riffles, which are these slightly raised teeth along the bottom. And it would catch in them, and then the water couldn't, you know, carry it forward because it was too heavy. And so then after all the silt and dirt had washed away, you could just pick out the nuggets.
Wow.
And that, I mean, that's just one kind of mining. Then, of course, you know, there's gold is found in hard rock. And in order to get that, you got to crush it. You just have to smash the heck out of it.
And is that what you, I think pickaxes with miners.
Yeah, well, and we have some great pickaxes in the exhibit.
You're a little too enthusiastic about these sharp tools. I'm worried about you.
yeah, you know, the pickaxes would be, you know, for carving, you know, larger hunks of rock out of the ground, or just digging generally into the ground, you know, breaking loose earth to then process by running through the rockers, that sort of thing. And then, of course, you know, in the exhibit, we're focusing on these historic rushes, but gold mining is still a major economic activity in the West, particularly in the Black Hills in South Dakota. So we trace that history really up to the present day in some regards. And so the evolution of that technology and how much more advanced technologically it is today.
Sure. So we always think of gold as something desirable for decorative reasons, jewelry or gold leafing or whatever. Does contemporary gold that's mined have other uses? Is it used in technology? Is it used in industry?
Yeah, it's a lot of gold is used in things like circuit boards and computer mechanisms. That sort of, you know, high tech industry uses gold. Gold wiring.
Yeah. So when people essentially put their lives on hold or abandoned their lives and went out to one of these territories, sure that they were going to be the lottery winner, because it your description makes it sound the likelihood of striking gold is just as slim as winning the lottery. But did they mostly leave their families behind?
Certainly in the first waves of these rushes, you see that. That's not true across the board. There are always exceptions.
Right.
But sort of as the rushes progress and as the camps become more permanent and also, you know, cities develop, you know, like San Francisco develops because of the gold rush in California, that sort of thing, you see more more families and more sort of large groups traveling together west. And of course, you know, from the get-go, this is far from being just a white man's story. There are people of all kinds participating in all of these gold rushes from day one. We've got some spectacular historic photographs in the exhibit that really illustrate that diversity. You know, you've got women right in there working the sluice boxes next to their partners, Chinese workers, African-American workers, people from the Hawaiian Islands, Native people, of course, you know, from all of these different regions are absolutely a part of the story, both in terms of their participation in gold mining and then their interactions with these outsiders coming into their homes.
So tell me about Fool's Gold.
Well, Fool's Gold is pyrite, and it's very shiny. I think it looks very different from gold. I've always been somewhat perplexed by the moniker Fool's Gold. To me, it looks really different, but it's just another kind of natural formation you might find that a lot of people mistake for gold. Obviously,
sure.
We do have a little bit of it in the exhibit, just to kind of show the contrast of real gold versus Fool's Gold.
And at your opening event, you give people a chance to kind of feel what it's like to pan for gold, right?
Not so much with the panning on the opening night. At the opening party, we are going to have a mini gold rush, though. And so we're going to have fake gold. I don't know if it's actually fool's gold or if it's just, you know, rocks painted gold or that sort of thing. But we are going to have fake gold in some parts of the museum that people can hunt for.
Cool.
And then whoever has the most by weight at the end of the evening is going to win a fabulous prize.
Well, that's a treat.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. We will have gold panning once it gets a little warmer out.
Okay, sure.
We will have a hands-on gold panning unit on the back terrace, which I think will be a lot of fun for families, but really people of all ages. And that will be Fool's Gold that you'll be panning for there.
I'm eager to see, you have some photos of spectacular artifacts that are in this exhibit. Tell me some of your favorite items made from gold.
Oh, let's see. Well, there's this fabulous gold pocket watch from Alaska that's has this like star motif on it and a diamond set into it. It's just stunning. It's beautiful.
Wow.
And we have a spectacular collection of gold quartz jewelry. And gold quartz is another way you could find gold naturally, you know, the gold veins running through quartz stone. And the way gold quartz jewelry is made, it's sort of slices of that rock that are taken. So you see
that, sounds gorgeous.
That matrix of gold running through, you know, the white quartz or the rose quartz. It's just beautiful. So you see a lot of that. That was particularly common in California. And it's sort of a style of jewelry that you often see associated with California gold. And we have a beautiful case of that. Just beautiful brooches and cufflinks and
all sorts of treats.
Pocket watches. Yeah, just amazing stuff. There's also this fabulous gold hair comb that has gold nuggets all over it. There's just some spectacular stuff in the show.
Sharon Gamble with Idle Drawer curator Joanna Bloom. See gold bars, gold nuggets, gold jewelry, and much, much more at Gold, Riches, and Ruin, opening this Saturday at the Idle Drawer. The exhibit runs through August 9th and features lots of fun programming that you can learn about at idlejorg.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Since leaving NUVO, Jim Poyser's been leading Earth Charter Indiana, an organization that works towards mobilizing young people to actively learn about the environment and to volunteer to make it better. Lately, they've been incorporating art into that process. Travis DiNicola spoke with Poyser to learn more.
Jim, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you again.
Great to be here, Travis.
Yeah, I'm so glad. I've been looking forward to this conversation, to learning more about Earth Charter and what you're doing there, especially some really cool art projects we're going to talk about in just a minute. But before we get to all that, Earth Charter Indiana, what exactly is it?
Well, Earth Charter Indiana is actually probably the only chapter of the Earth Charter in the United States. There are chapters all over the world. The Earth Charter is actually this beautiful document that was created in the late 90s, early 2000s, by hundreds of people from many, many different countries. And the people that created this document were, it was dawning on them that we couldn't solve any one problem, whether it was environmental mm-hmm. problems or peace and justice problems or poverty problems, without finding some of the interconnections between them.
Okay.
And in other words, to sort of build a fusion of people that would want to get together and try and make positive, peaceful change mm-hmm. in their individual countries, but also increasingly we have to work together as countries to take care of the planet. So Earth Charter Indiana is a chapter of the International Earth Charter.
Hmm.
And I joined about a year and a half ago now as its
executive
director.
I just
director.
Assumed that there were Earth Charters in most states. But
well, no, there are actually a couple. I've tried to hunt them down.
Yeah.
And they're sort of dormant.
Okay.
I think we have a pretty robust group, got a great mm-hmm. board of directors and lots of great volunteers.
And as you said, I'm sorry.
A lot of fun stuff.
I interrupted you. You became the executive director of Earth Charter Indiana about a year and a half ago?
About a year and a half ago, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so in a way, you're kind of the founder of it's part of a larger group, but you're the local founder, right?
No, not at all. Actually, yeah. In 2001, John Gibson and Jerry King founded Earth Charter Indiana. And this happened according to John and Jerry, if they were mm-hmm. here, they would tell you the story that Earth Charter formed just a few weeks before 9/11 happened.
Hmm.
And so the first meeting that they had, there was an awful lot of people who came very, very traumatized and concerned
sure.
about that extraordinary event in our history. And, so it was really important that Earth Charter came about at that moment in time.
Now, a big part of what you do is working with kids, young people under 18, basically. I mean, trying to sort of get them engaged in both learning but also volunteering.
Yeah, well, and volunteering but also raising them to leadership, I think, is the key element here. So the kind of the tagline of Earth Charter Indiana is for our children's children.
Mm-hmm.
So a convergence of things happened for me. I was trained as a climate reality presenter a couple years ago. And while I was still at NUVO and Indiana Living Green, I began to do some presentations, volunteering my time in churches and art galleries and schools and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going to CFI IPS number 2 just under 2 years ago now. It was in April of 2013. And I'd never thought I would go to an elementary school to sort of deliver a message about climate change and our impending climate crisis. And I went into this school, and these kids were just totally brilliant. You know, 10, mm-hmm. 11, 12-year-old kids, just so sophisticated in their thinking, systems thinking and sustainability measures and actions. And I walked out of there, and I just said to myself, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
I had no idea how I was going to do it or where I was going to do it. Really was a convergence of some pretty magical things. So I do spend a lot of time in schools with kids and to present to them, but more and more to engage them in sustainability projects and art projects and service to the environment.
That's a really cool thing to be able
it's
to do.
It's the best job ever. Yeah. I used to say NUVO was the best job ever, and it was cool. It was really cool, but
this is even better.
Even more amazing, yes.
So let's talk about one of these specific projects that you're using to engage kids in this process. And this is the it came out, actually, from an idea of a young lady, a student that you'd been working with, if I'm correct on this, an artist. Molly, is that?
Yeah, Molly Denning at Pike High School.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't actually even working with her. We had a meeting mm-hmm. To discuss a potential internship, and so many really highly motivated and intelligent kids. She took a good look at her schedule and said, sorry, can't do it.
Yeah.
And I was disappointed, of course, but she was a remarkable person, so we stayed in contact, and I think we just sort of started talking about the arts at some mm-hmm. point in our email exchange, and she sent me a picture of monarch butterflies that she had created from the pages of discarded National Geographics.
Which are really cool.
They
I've seen
amazing
photographs of these butterflies, and you know, I mean, so many of us subscribe to National Geographic, love the magazine, feel like we can't throw them away, and what do we do with them? And to see them be turned into monarch butterflies. I just thought it was a great idea.
Yeah,
I've got a whole stack for her if she needs them. But,
you could use origami to create all sorts of endangered species. But she chose monarch butterflies, and it just kind of sparked the idea. So I thought, I know who I'll go talk to.
Hmm.
Shannon Linker.
Mm-hmm. At the Arts Council.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sure a frequent guest here. Mm-hmm. And she was just immediately impacted like I was by the art. Now, the idea was crazy at that point because I'm just like a kid in a candy shop at all times at this point. I need someone to reel me in a bit. So Shannon said, instead of all kinds of endangered species, let's pick something that's endangered here in Indiana, mm-hmm. one species. And I thought, that's a good idea. So we picked the butterflies yeah. one, obviously, because we had that on hand. But then the next idea is, well, let's just ask all Indiana artists to do it, student artists. And she said, no, let's find out what's actually confluent with standards.
Sure. Okay.
So we talked to Arts for Learning, yep. Indiana, mm-hmm. Ploy, yep. Was very helpful to us in determining that fourth and fifth graders would be the best target artists mm-hmm. For this.
Yeah. Neat. So right now you've had sort of an open call to fourth and fifth graders who want to be a part of this, right?
I've had about two dozen elementary school art teachers from mm-hmm. around the state mm-hmm. respond affirmatively. They want to do this. From Vincennes to
and so they're doing it in their
Michigan
classrooms.
City. Yes, they're doing it as part of their curriculum. In fact, this aforementioned CFI, mm-hmm. IPS number 2, they said they're going to do it to blow off steam next week after the I-STEPS.
Oh, that's great.
Which I thought is a great way to wind down from the stress of that. So, yeah, lots and lots. I'm sure we have hundreds.
And the idea is that they're going to be not just using National Geographics, but all types of reclaimed materials repurposed mm-hmm. To create butterflies. And then they're going to be on exhibit at the Arts Garden.
All of April, they're going to be swarming from the ceiling and hanging on the windows. And I think it's going to be beautiful. It's also the opportunity to talk about the science surrounding yeah. monarch butterflies, the use of herbicides on our agriculture system that is actually unintentionally killing off the milkweed, which is the habitat that monarchs need to survive. There are other stresses on the monarch mm-hmm. Butterflies as well, just human development in general, and climate changes as well as changing their migratory patterns somewhat. But it is one of those ecological problems you can actually do something about, and that's what's so much fun.
That's really
is
cool.
That the you know you can grow milkweed, mm-hmm. and I hope that what comes out of this is people see that this is actually one of those enormous problems that you can. Take a crack at and actually do something about.
Can you, for milkweed, can you get seeds for it?
Oh, absolutely. Yes,
okay.
You can get seeds. In fact, there are milkweed seeds available to nonprofits and to schools, which I'm connecting the schools to those resources
yeah. okay.
as well. But there's a whole other element to this. I mean, first of all, the partners on this are just like a great lineup. Keep mm-hmm. Indianapolis Beautiful loves this idea,
mm-hmm.
of
sure.
course, because they actually do butterfly habitat in their work. Keep Indianapolis Beautiful. Indiana Recycling Coalition, mm-hmm. of course, loves it because we're using only repurposed materials, only materials that have no other life mm-hmm. after they're done. Nopal Cultural Center is going to help us make this a bilingual event. Brick Street Poetry is going to help us thread poetry into this. And Earth Day Indiana is going to help us showcase this Arts Garden exhibit at Earth Day Indiana Festival on April 25th.
Nice.
There are probably more.
And of course, you already mentioned the Arts Council and yeah, also Arts yeah. for Learning.
Absolutely.
Now, can kids still get involved with this?
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm just asking
kind of pushing
teachers
the limit,
to email me. We're going to ask teachers to deliver by the end of March,
yeah.
1st of April. We don't know exactly when we're going to get into the Arts Garden with these butterflies,
okay.
but they can still email me.
Okay. And get information from your website.
Absolutely.
And stuff.
Yes.
So you are not limited to the visual arts at all in terms of what you've been doing to connect people to their environment. You also have been doing off and on for a year and a half now, the Ain't Too Late Show. Now, you mentioned earlier how, part of the way you first even got connected with Earth Charter Indiana because you were going into schools and talking to kids about stuff. And that has evolved, that presentation. I know you still do lots of presentations, but in some ways, what you've been doing has kind of evolved into the world's first climate change game show.
Yeah, you know,
which
really,
I need to also say that I have emceed. So,
in full disclosure, Travis, yes. we should in fact remark that when I started this game show, I said, "Who do I want to to co-host with me?" And I reached out to you, and also reached out to Karen Irwin.
Yeah,
Who's just a
great
mega
actress,
talent.
Musician, talent, amazing.
And Sean Baker,
mm-hmm. Incredible, the music man. Sean Baker, the music maker, yeah, great piano player. It's a fun team that you've put together. And but tell me, I mean, it started out as an indie fringe show originally, and then it's kind of evolved into that and continues to be performed at the Fringe.
Yeah, my background is theater. I started with a playwrights project, but way back in 1979 as a playwright and director and actor. And you know, you get involved in your career path, mm-hmm. and you sort of leave those things behind. But I've always continued to have a great appreciation for our wonderful theater entities here in Indianapolis, and seeing as many shows as I can, and then keeping my own hand in it from time to time as well. So yes, I did do a one-man show called Saving the World Through Bumper Stickers, mm-hmm. At the Fringe a couple years ago. And then what grew out of that was this climate change game show. You know, again, this idea of the enormity of our ecological challenges, all of our challenges across the silos, across the categories. Everything just seems so stressful and hard and dark and all that kind of stuff. And my nature is not to be dark, although I was getting there, I must say.
But, I mean, even the title, I think, is so great because, of course, you know, it plays off the idea of The Late Show, but it's that it ain't too late, that people can still do something, they can still make choices in their everyday life right now that are going to affect the environment in a positive way.
Yes.
And that's what the game show is about.
It is,
and learning about what they can do.
It's about having fun.
It is about
laughing.
Fun.
It's about laughing. And
with cutthroat competition.
Cutthroat competition, that's right. You know, I started doing this in schools, too. I don't think that was the original idea, but it occurred to me when I was going into a high school, for example, to do the game show was probably a better strategy than going in with some long, drawn-out climate science
makes it more fun.
Presentation.
Well, before we wrap things up, I do want to just mention that for a while you were doing the Ain't Too Late show about every month or so at the Fringe, took a little hiatus, a little restructuring, and now it is coming back on March 20th, Friday, March 20th, which I'm pretty excited about.
Yeah, you know, Pauline Moffitt is, I'm sure that you know, she's just such a creative
mm-hmm.
person, And I was a little lost. You know, we'd do this monthly, and we'd have 12 people one night and 80 mm-hmm. the following month. And it just, I can't stay on top of this sort of chaos. and Pauline said, well, why don't you make it quarterly and do it on a Friday night? So that's what we're going to do. We're going to start doing this on a Friday, once a quarter.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely want to have some big-name guest stars. I mean, even bigger than you, Travis.
Well, okay.
But they said no so far, so we'll leave that as suspenseful for now. But it's going to be the same music and fun mm-hmm. and audience participation. I'd like to get some kids involved, actually.
Cool.
And people can win fabulous prizes. They can indeed.
Yeah.
We've got the Good Earth is actually coming on board as a
nice.
Sponsor, and we'll also have gift certificates from other great local merchants.
I'm sure we will. Jim, great to hear what you're up to. Really love the way that you're connecting the arts to your environmental education advocacy work, and especially your work with kids. Thanks so much for coming on Are the Manor.
Thank you, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with Earth Charter Indiana's Jim Poyser. To learn more about the organization, visit earthcharterindiana.org. And if you have fourth or fifth graders interested in participating in the Monarch Butterfly Art Exhibit at the Arts Garden in April, then visit the earthcharterindiana.org website now to register for updates and learn how to submit artwork. And you can go see Jim Poyser and Travis DiNicola and a whole cast of other quote-unquote characters when they perform the Ain't Too Late show at the Indie Fringe on Friday, March 20th. More information about that at indiefringe.org. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
I have not one, but two events that
two?
You can practice your toast-making prowess for.
That sounds like fun. I'm ready for them.
All right.
Should we talk about them on that calendar that we call?
What do we do? Indeed, we should. If you're hearing us Thursday night, don't forget Indie Wine Fest Friday night.
What?
Benefits, WFYI.
Yeah. Oh, it's a great event. And you can taste all sorts of wines and have great foods. And Sharon, you and I will both be there.
We will at Union Station this Friday night, 6 to 9. So mm-hmm. If you're hearing us Saturday morning, well, if you were at Wine Fest, you're probably not hearing us Saturday
there you go.
Morning. You're probably sleeping
in. The other event, by the way, is, of course, St. Patrick's Day is coming up
That's
very
so
soon.
True.
We'll have more about that on a future calendar.
I can't wait for that.
Mm-hmm. You can have something to drink at the Jazz Kitchen on Sunday night. Why would you go there? Well, at 7 o'clock, there is a CD debut party for the Icarus Ensemble's very first CD featuring some of their favorite tunes and audience favorites as well. That's at the Jazz Kitchen this Sunday night, the 8th, starting at 7 o'clock. And, of course, great food as well as lovely music available there.
That sounds awesome. Mm-hmm. Hey, there's a lot of First Friday events going on all over town on Friday night. One you might want to check out a little bit off the beaten path is over at the Heron School of Art and Design in their galleries. Dorothy Alleg is doing, has a show called Spin in the Basile Gallery. And it's actually going to be up through March 28th. So if you missed the Friday night opening, you can still get a chance to go see it. But some really beautiful work combining digital printmaking, traditional printmaking, drawing, painting, and sort of playing on the word spin with some great abstract work. Again, Dorothy Alleg, and that's going to be through March 28th at the Basile Gallery at Heron.
Love it. Hey, you've heard of Dinner and a Movie. How about Serial and Cinema? It's a new series that rotates between the Athenaeum and the Indianapolis Museum of Art on the first Saturday of each month. It's at 10 o'clock this Saturday, March 7th, this time at the IMA. The film is Breakin' 2, Electric Boogaloo, Serial Cinema. Okay, I can't make this stuff up.
No, you can't. Well, you know, the IMA is doing on Saturday at 11 a hip-hop university program for kids. Yeah.
So you can go and do two crazy things back to back.
Goodness. Hey, March 18th, Twyla Tharp, the incredible choreographer, dancer, is going to be at University of Indianapolis, and looking forward to hearing that. She's just a real Indiana legend, and that will be a very cool part of their humanities series. You can get more information if you visit the uindy.edu website. Seating is limited. General admission tickets are available, though, now.
Last but not least, Indie Folk Series presents An Evening with Carrie Newcomer on March 14th at UUI. And don't forget, you can learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide.
That's right. Hey, Sharon, before we go, though, since it is the beginning of March, we have to do our traditional lion roar.
Oh!
Roar! Because later this month, or at least we hope so. Okay, we'll have more sound effects and things to do next week on the calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
If you're a foodie, it's a great time to live in Indianapolis. Entrepreneur Karen Kennedy has taken the idea of local dining up a notch with special foodie tours run by her company, Small Potatoes Exceptional Events. Sharon Gamble recently chatted with Karen Kennedy and chef Abby David about the company and its tours.
So, Karen, I read on your LinkedIn profile that now you know what you want to do for a living.
Right. I finally figured out what I want to be when I grow up. It took me 51 years.
Tell me about that journey. Where did you think you were headed?
Well, you know, I grew up in a small town in northern Indiana, in Huntington. And I grew up with my mother's cooking, which focused primarily on Jell-O and cream of mushroom soup. So I thought I was eating well until I left Huntington and went to Chicago.
Oh, my goodness.
Fine dining restaurants
there.
Right, exactly. And then I thought, oh, so garlic actually comes in a bulb and not in a shaker with a McCormick's label on it. So my eyes were open to the culinary world there.
Aw. And then you thought, so were you headed towards becoming a chef? Or what did you think you were going to do in the food world?
I was always in the front of the house. I focused primarily on service and training and event planning.
Mm-hmm.
So I was more the one who had the idea for the party, and then I left it to those talented people in the kitchen to make the party happen.
Sure. So how'd you end up in Indianapolis from Chicago? That's a trip right there.
It is a trip, and it was a circuitous path. I went to Butler my freshman year in college. Then I went to Indiana University, studied vocal performance there, mm-hmm. moved to Chicago and worked as a singer for many years, and then ended up in the restaurant business. I was in Chicago for 10 years, then I moved to Vermont. I was in Vermont for 3 years.
Wow.
Landed in Goshen in northern Indiana. I was in Goshen for 14 years, and then returned to Indianapolis last year.
Wow, you've had quite an interesting culinary tour, because from Vermont and Goshen, you probably got some really fresh foods, you know, farm to table, maybe even before that phrase was coined, right?
Definitely. I think Vermont probably had that going on a little bit before Indianapolis did.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. So how did you decide to create the Small Potatoes Company?
You know, I wanted to return to the food business. I was working as a freelance writer. And realized that I kind of missed the people contact. I thought I was living my dream until I realized I had to sit by myself all day as a writer. So I thought, well, what can I do that won't be a return to a brick-and-mortar store but will still be involved in event planning and making parties happen for people, making fun happen? And that's when I decided to start an event planning business.
Mm-hmm. And that's a kind of crowded field already. What did you decide would be your niche to set you apart?
It is a crowded field, and it's funny because the name of my company comes from what we wanted our niche to be. I was talking to a friend, and he said, oh, I'll hook you up with all kinds of event planners downtown. I know all the big fish down there. And I said, I don't want to swim with the big fish. I want the events that those people would think were small potatoes.
Ah.
And then I said, oh, actually, I think I know what I'm going to call my company.
Cute, and descriptive, because you focus on parties for fewer than
150, but our sweet spot is 50 to 75. Mm-hmm. And primarily we just do hors d'oeuvre type of events.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the event planning end of things that led us toward the foodie tours.
Yeah. So, Abby, I'm going to bring you in here because you're a chef. How did you get involved with Small Potatoes?
Well, actually, I'm an amateur chef, but I am an adventurous culinarian, I would say. So I'm one of the Small Potatoes. I'm just a part of Karen's cadre of talented. She finds people that have great talents and brings them together, and so I'm just one of those Small Potatoes.
So we know Karen grew up with cuisine that was of its time, maybe not the most adventuresome. Did you grow up in a foodie family, or did you find adventure on your own?
Oh, no, I think I probably had a very good culinary background, and I spent a lot of time with my mom in the kitchen and learning techniques, and I think that's the thing that a lot of people miss, is that they aren't brave about cooking in the kitchen. So they're afraid they'll make a mistake. They really want to follow recipes to the T. They don't want to test anything. And that's where the creativity, where people miss out. And so that's why people are surprised by things that are made by creative people.
And maybe they try a recipe once and it doesn't come out right, and they say, I can't cook.
Right, absolutely.
Just mm-hmm. throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Just have to test and keep going until you find something that works.
Somebody, when you said that you were adventurous, flashed on, what does she cook? Frogs? Newts? Toads?
Bat wings?
No bat wings and hummingbird tongues with small potatoes, no. I think the other thing that Karen really brings to the party is some really beautiful food. So we really try to make things that are accessible, but we use as fresh and local ingredient as we can find, and then to put it out in a beautiful presentation. So mm-hmm. no bat wings, but, you know, we use some quinoa occasionally, and we use better meats and better cheeses and better fruits and vegetables that we can find.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Maybe locally sourced when possible.
Yeah. Whenever possible, we try our very best, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so talk about your interest in foodie tours. Was this kind of everybody on the staff sat down one day and said, There's a market out there for these tours, or is that your brainchild, Karen? Or?
It is. Actually, a friend of mine and I were talking about some walking tours that she had done in South Carolina.
Hmm.
And I said, you know, we could do that here, but we really can't walk. So
it is a car town,
right,
isn't it?
Exactly. So we started kicking around the idea of a way that we could support local restaurants by, you know, putting them on a motor coach and driving them around to different restaurants. And that was how the idea for the foodie tours came to be.
So for somebody who's thinking, well, why can't I just go to the restaurant myself? Or why can't I just go to three restaurants on Mass Ave myself? What is the value that you add?
Well, you could go to all those restaurants yourself, but you might not get to meet the chef. And you wouldn't have a menu that was pre-planned for you. So our concept is that we choose four locally owned independent restaurants and only locally owned independent restaurants. We plan a tour that has a tasting menu at each stop. So we're in each restaurant for about 45 minutes, and we get to meet the chefs, who we feel are artists. They get to explain their craft to us and explain a little bit about the history of their restaurant. We do a brief Q&A. The people who participate in the tours also get to speak to the chefs and ask their questions. And the chefs really will sit down and interact with the group for a couple of minutes. And so we're in each restaurant for 45 minutes. We taste the best of what they have to offer. We hear their stories, and then the coach is waiting to take us to the next stop. And we do four in a night, and then we bring everyone back to the starting point.
How long have you been doing these tours?
Since November.
Man, you really collectively in your business had your instincts fine-tuned, because it has become a place that's fabulous for foodies to live. All the new independent restaurants. Mm-hmm. Something reached, what do you think? It feels like something reached critical mass here, and lots of chefs and entrepreneurs have suddenly said, it's okay to start a restaurant here now. What do you think has shifted here? What made that possible?
I think the most positive change that I've seen, I mean, I lived in Indianapolis in 1980, I'm dating myself, the early 80s, shall mm-hmm. we say, and it was a chain town. You know, pretty much every restaurant was a chain. And I think once the chefs realized that people were willing to support an independent restaurant, you know, it became kind of a jumping off point for people to realize that they could really get into supporting locally owned restaurants. And once that started to happen, I think more and more chefs just keep jumping into the pool. You know, people are willing to stand and wait in line to get into a restaurant
yeah.
now. And that's a beautiful thing.
So for somebody who's grew up with going to all those chain restaurants and wants to get more involved as a foodie, other than beyond coming on one of your foodie tours, what is some general advice you would give to people who are like, maybe they're not like Abby culinarily adventurous, but mm-hmm. they'd like to be? They'd like to kind of ease in that direction?
You know, I think really moreover, the idea of being adventurous would be the idea of supporting local, you know, really thinking if you're going to make a commitment to dine in a local restaurant, to support these creative artists who are putting their whole lives on the line, they're taking everything they have and they're putting it into a restaurant. And if you really just think, I'm going to make an effort to do this and only this. And I'm not saying none of us are ever going to eat at a chain, but if we really have a choice between picking up the phone and calling a chain restaurant and ordering 10 sandwiches for lunch, or reaching around your neighborhood and looking for the little mom and pop sandwich shop on the corner, or making a choice to drive a couple extra minutes to get to Mass Ave and check out one of the new restaurants down there as opposed to, you know, going to the chain around the corner from you. I think it's more about making a commitment to celebrating the art and the work of these local business owners.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe once you're there, try something you never tried before.
Yeah, there we go. Abby, your take on the same idea, what advice would you give to somebody who wants to just break out of that box and try something new?
Well, I think that the interesting thing about the locals is, or local restaurants, is they really provide a lot of the things that you're used to eating and seeing, but with a little bit of a different twist. So if you really like steak, or if you really like a pork tenderloin sandwich, there are some really interesting places out there that have something that's really neat, like a pretzel-crusted pork tenderloin slider or something that you can really find what you want, and you can adventure that way. Start with something you know. Order an appetizer or something that you've heard about that you don't know, and go from there.
And maybe go with friends so that
and you can taste.
It's not to your taste. You can
right. We're Midwesterners. We share.
Is that why it's so good to live here? So warm and gracious. So, tell me something unexpected that's happened on one of these tours.
Well, I think the thing that that we're enjoying the most is the camaraderie that comes of the tours.
Uh-huh.
The first couple of tours we did. We had some people that came from that had read about it on a meetup group. You know, there are different ways that we promote the tours.
Sure.
And so when we first arrived, everyone was sort of sitting quietly and keeping to themselves. And
aww.
So we were doing our best to introduce everyone to everyone else. And by the third stop, we stopped at Upland Brewing Company in Carmel, and they brought out tastes of beer, three different beers for everyone. And all of these people who didn't know each other were taking a sip and saying, oh, I don't like this. You take my IPA, aww, and I'll take your stout. And they're just trading. They're literally drinking out of each other's glasses after like an hour and a half of dining together. So there was a real camaraderie, and we realized, you know, people could really have a great time on these tours and get to know, you know, kind of expand their network of foodies, get to know people who love food as much as they do, and then enjoy a lot of different places.
Which kind of brings me to what one of your target groups for these is as a team building.
Exactly. Yes, that's a new area that we're reaching into is marketing our tours to organizations who might be looking to do a team building. Maybe after a day of training, we could use the tours to as kind of an employee motivation thing. And then we've also partnered with a company called Circle City Game Shows, which is, again, a local, independently owned business.
Mm-hmm.
Fabulous people there. And they have these really remarkable state-of-the-art game shows where they have, you know, electronic scoreboards and television monitors. And we're doing customized game shows. So if we had, say, a rehearsal dinner, we would take everyone on the rehearsal dinner, all the family and friends of the bride and groom, on a little culinary adventure as an alternative to a traditional rehearsal dinner. And then it would end in a customized game show where the questions would be about the bride and groom. Or if it were a corporate event and they were in training all day, then we would take them out to dinner, show them all around the town. And then at the last stop, the game show host would be waiting, and they could have a customized game show with questions that were all about the training that they'd had that day to see who retained what.
So
and team
fun.
Building, because, you know, I'd want somebody like Abby on my team because she's like a human calculator, so she would remember everything, and then we would win because Abby would be on the team.
So restaurant, I know that I can't ask you your favorite restaurant because all of your children are pretty, and you're building relationships with lots of chefs, but tell me, each of you, a restaurant that's just opened or that's about to open that you're really psyched about.
That's a good
question. Or maybe
question.
A style of food that you'd like to see more restaurateurs delving into.
You know, one of my favorite restaurants in the city is Oakley's Bistro.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve Oakley has been doing what he does for a very long time, but he's been at Oakley's, I think, since around 2002. And I am such a fan of the restaurant because the food is art. It's truly art. Every plate is a piece of artwork. It's amazing to me that he, for all these years, has just been kind of on the cutting edge. And I'm seeing a new trend with new chefs where, you know, they might push the envelope a little farther than some people are comfortable with. And there's kind of this rock star mentality,
sure,
coming from the young chefs, which I think is cool. And it's, you know, definitely keeping the culinary scene vibrant. But I think it's important, too, to kind of stay true to the roots of, you know, what the food should look like, what it should taste like. And I think it's important that the chef is committed to the guests really enjoying their meal as opposed to, you know, kind of pursuing their own vision and not necessarily keeping the guests' interest in mind.
Mm-hmm.
That's a trend that disturbs mm-hmm. me a little bit, is mm-hmm. the menu substitutions will be politely declined.
Mm. You will eat what I prepare.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. And I mean, I see that, and I think that it's important that everyone respect a chef's vision, but I also think it's important for all restaurants to remember who signs their paycheck, and that's the guest.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a profession where you're reviewed every day, every meal,
right,
every service.
Right.
Abby, a kind of food you'd like to see more of in Indianapolis?
Well, I think we are doing a good job of contemporary American food here in Indianapolis. I think it would be really nice to see a little bit more of authentic, you know, we have some good authentic Mexican cuisine. I think some good authentic Chinese cuisine would be good to see, or some Asian. We've got a lot of Asian fusion, and I think that's a stepping stone to bring people more into eating out and enjoying things that they like. But I think it would be really great to see. We have growing populations of immigrants to Indianapolis all the time. It would be really great to see some of those people open up and have restaurants that are mom and pop joints that are local to Indianapolis, but maybe have some kind of cultural twist that we're not used to seeing all the time.
Sharon Gamble with founder Karen Kennedy and chef Abby David of Small Potatoes Exceptional Events. Tours of Mass Ave, Fountain Square, and Broderpool are coming up soon. You can learn more about them all at smallpotatoesindy.com. Again, smallpotatoesindy.com. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. I'll find out some of the highlights going on at Clues Memorial Hall this spring.
I'll chat with Barb Shoup about what is new at the Writers Center this spring.
And I'll get a preview of this year's Indiana Artisan Marketplace and the Maple Syrup Festival as well. And we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.